Welcome to the Forged by Trust podcast. I'm your host, Robin Drake, executive coach, former U.S. Marine, spy recruiter, best-selling author, and your trust and communication expert. Today's episode, Body Language Tactics, is with my good friend Scott Rouse and his incredible online course, co-taught with the acclaimed Greg Hartley. Want to know the truth? Want to know what someone else is really thinking or feeling? Then this course is for you. They're going to give you a critical advantage over 99% of the people you come into contact with. Some might say it's an unfair advantage. Specifically, they're going to give you 30 simple tools to spot lies, create trust, and know what others are thinking before they say a word. So why join? They give you the keys to baselining correctly, recognizing real and fake expressions, spotting lies, observing people and situations properly, know what someone is thinking before they say a word, transmitting powerful yet subtle body language cues. Coming up next on the Forged by Trust podcast.
It was my father. He was a doctor, and he recently passed away in August. And his thing was, when I was little, I sort of got into what someone was going to do next by 5 or 6 years old. I was like, I think this person's going to do that. And he was like, what are you talking about? I said, it looks like they're going to do this because they did. And so with body language, if you understand that, you can work in any place. I've focused on healthcare a lot because I understand that world and I understand doctors, how to talk to them.
Yeah.
Doctors and healthcare people having problems communicating with the patients and the people surrounding that. I'm trying to fix that. As corny as that sounds, that's my deep dive. But I knew there was a way to explain these things so everybody could easily understand it.
Welcome to the show. I'm Robin Drake. And on the Forged by Trust podcast, we decode the interpersonal communication skills of the world's most acclaimed forgers of trust. We unlock the skills and techniques from spies, spy recruiters, master interrogators, globally recognized behavioral experts, C-suite executives, entrepreneurs, acclaimed authors, and thought leaders. Each episode provides specific actions that you can immediately apply to any aspect of your personal or professional life. Today's episode is with my good friend, the acclaimed Scott Rouse. Scott Rouse is an internationally recognized author, speaker, body language expert, and trainer. As a behavior analyst and body language expert, Scott Rouse holds multiple certificates in advanced interrogation training and has been trained alongside the FBI, Secret Service, U.S. Military Intelligence, and the Department of Defense. His extensive training, education, and practice of nonverbal communication has made him an expert and consultant to law enforcement as well as Fortune 100 companies, attorneys, private investigators, executives, and entertainers. He's also a TEDx speaker. Scott, along with Greg Hartley, Mark Bowden, and Chase Hughes, they are the top four body language experts in the world, created the popular YouTube channel, The Behavior Panel, where they analyze the body language and human behavior in videos of public interest. As a regular guest and consultant to and for the Dr. Phil Show, Scott analyzes body language and behavior. During today's episode, we talk about from rock and roll to creating the behavior panel, applying body language to all aspects of life, fixing how healthcare professionals communicate, and making human behavior understandable. Scott Rouse, the man, the legend, the guy, I am so grateful that I'm finally getting you on to close out and do, as Jim Pyle said the other week before I had him on, he goes, when's Scott coming on? You got to run the table, man. So thank you for taking time to come on the Humble Forged by Trust show.
Thanks for having me. And I'm sorry because I'm late and that's all my fault. And I'm so sorry about that. I mean, I told you about all the stuff that's going on, but still, I'm so sorry.
When you are doing all you do, both as you as Scott Rouse, your own company, the stuff you're doing with Greg, and then the behavior panel, I mean, that alone can make your head spin. And then when you add your life behind it, that's insurmountable. So no needs for apologies here. We're all in those spaces. I am just extremely grateful. And more importantly, the audience is grateful because everyone has these amazing backstories, as we've seen over the last bunch of weeks. And so with that, I'm going to kick off with my favorite question ever, is trying to dive deeper and understand the mastery that we see in before us. And that is you. You have this uncanny, amazing ability, and because we'll eventually get into how the behavior panel started, because I know you are the spark and glue behind that entire thing, because you have this amazing ability to know what people want to see, hear, and think. And with that skill set, it required, I believe, a lifetime of mastery of observation. But you're also this fantastic musician. That's why I came up with the title for this one, Rockstar Body Language.
That's hilarious.
It is you. It is you in a few words, rockstar and body language. So, you know, Scott, with that, all those years ago, what's the thread and the spark that started this power of observation that brought you where you are today?
It was my father. He was a doctor, and he recently passed away in August. And his thing was, when I was little, I sort of got into what someone was going to do next. And I mean, by 5 or 6 years old, I was like, I think this person's going to do that. And he was like, what are you talking about? I said, it looks like they're going to do this because they did. So I was into leading up what they were going to do next, which of course has gone to pre-violence and all, you know, being able to tell if somebody's carrying something they shouldn't be, all this kind of thing. So he said, he goes, that's called a behavior. And so he talked me through all that. And since I was interested in how people acted, one time my mom would come and get my brother and sister and I from school. Not my brother. He was too young to be in school.
So where did you grow up? How old was this? And what kind of doctor was your dad? You know, a little bit of framing for context for me to understand in my small brain.
All right. Sorry, man. Yeah, I get to talking. It's hard to shut me up and just keep going.
No, you're good. I'm the one who's interrupting poorly. So go ahead. Backstory.
We lived in Louisa, Kentucky at the time. My dad was the only doctor in the whole town at this time. And I think I was in the second or third grade. And there were a couple of guys. And in this town, it was like, you know, 1,500 people, 2,000 people in the whole town. He was the doctor. He just come out of the Air Force he was a flight surgeon in the Vietnam War.
Oh, wow.
So what he would do, we never saw him as little kids because he was always so busy. He was always on. And my mom would come to school, which is, we lived literally right next door to the school. There's a 312 Boone Street in Louisa, Kentucky, lived right next door to the school. And she'd come get my sister and I and bring my little brother with her. And we'd walk down, which wasn't very far, to the hospital and have lunch with my dad. And so his office was this, it was two rooms, two big rooms. He was the surgeon. He was the everything. He was the only doctor at the time. So we were in this like a big closet, which was his office, and we would eat lunch. And I looked out in the little lobby thing, which is part, I guess, where a bedroom would go. And I saw two guys I knew from my class, Billy Elkins and Robert Bellamy.
He's still there. Why do you think you remember their names so well from back then? That's amazing.
Because I have a picture of them in my room. Because back then we were really tight. It was a small town. Everybody knew everybody. And Billy was my best friend. And then Robert was in my class. And we three hung out all the time. And I also have a picture of them up in my room where we're all standing out front doing something. So, they're always on my mind. Wow. Melissa Browning is one that's in the picture too, I think. But we're all standing there together in this picture. That's why it's one of the reasons I remember the most.
Right.
But I remember this because everything I've done has sort of come from this one situation where I said, shoot, how do you say it as a kid? You know, hey man, there's I know these two cats out here, man. That's Robert and Billy. And I said, why are they here? And my dad goes like this. He looked down and he goes, well, Robert is sick. He's got an earache, and Billy's pretending he's sick. He's nothing wrong with him. And I said, and of course, as a kid, however you say it, I said, how do you know that? He said, well, let's take a look at him. Let's take a look at the situation. Let's watch what they're doing. And so Robert was sitting there, had his hand on his ear, leaning on his mom. And my dad said, do you see how his mom looks like she's doesn't have her makeup on, her hair's not done like it usually is, and she's not wearing the clothes? I said, yeah. He said, that lets us know she's been up all night with Robert. She didn't have time to get ready this morning. She came down here as soon as she could. And she's been up all night. She looks tired. And he explained to me why she looked tired. I said, oh, okay. He said, well, now let's look at Billy. So we looked over at Billy and he said, now, you see how Billy's mom's got her makeup on, her hair's done, she looks rested and all that. And I said, yeah. He said, see how Billy's, I think it was Highlights magazines, you know, those things you read at the doctor's offices. Right. See how he's reading Highlights, or he's reading that magazine, his legs were like kicking like that off this little bench. And I said, yeah. He said, no, here's what's going to happen. And the next couple of minutes, he's going to look up at his mom sideways, and he's going to have a real sad looking face on him. He'll have a sad looking face. And when he looks up at his mom, he'll say something and then she'll kind of frown at him and she'll pat him on the arm and then he'll go back to reading his book and dangling his legs again. And I said, okay. And he did that. I thought, my God, my dad, he knows magic. You know, how could he tell this? You know? So then I was like fascinated with how you could tell because I was already into how could you do this? How can people do, how do you know what someone's going to do? And then he was telling me how you could tell what people were going to do, sort of profiling it. That's very basic level. And from that day forward, man, I was hooked. When we'd see people out, he goes, what's wrong with that guy? It'd be somebody with a crutch, you know, limping. And he goes, oh, his leg hurts. He goes, yeah, that's right, man. His leg hurts. those kind of things. So as I grew up, I really got into it. I just became fascinated with it. And I couldn't read very well back then. There wasn't a lot to read on behavior that I could understand, but my dad would go out and find things and he'd bring them home and read them to me or tell me about them. Well, you know, here's what this guy, he's a professor at a big university. He'd go on and tell me about the studies they did, but without saying these are the studies,
right?
Say, here's what he found out. And I'd be like, okay. And I just, for some reason, my brain would just save that stuff.
I'm sorry. You'd said that you had already been really interested in this stuff before this. When did that interest start?
I don't know. I would just see people. My parents would have people over and I would think, this guy doesn't like my dad, or this guy really likes my dad, or my mom, or this woman really doesn't like my mom. And I would watch them and see what, and I don't know what I was looking for. It's crazy. I don't even know what the hell I was looking for, but I remember watching things and these things became, and I remember thinking a long time ago, this person did this and I know he didn't like my dad. And this other person did this. I know he really did like my dad. And those, the people who didn't like him for whatever reason, they would act like this, or if they didn't like my mom or my brother or my sister or somebody I knew, they would do these things. And people who really liked them would do these other things. And so I just started putting in groups and go, that guy didn't, just too loud as a kid, you know, that guy doesn't like you while they're talking to him.
So, it's interesting. You keep using that word like. Why do you think it was so important to understand who liked your dad and didn't like your dad?
Well, I don't think it was just my dad. It was anybody.
Right.
You know, it was my mom, my dad, my sister, my brother, me, other people that I would watch. You know, we had a babysitter and I knew my brother didn't like her. You know, once I said, you don't like, but I would say it in front of these people. You know, now when I think about it, it's horrifying, not for a kid, but for adults.
Right.
And my mom didn't like a babysitter one time. And I said, you don't like her. And so what ended up happening, they would tell me to don't say anything about, right, those, you know, explain to me that's not good, that's rude and all that. So I don't know why the like part, but that was the first thing I realized. I started noticing whether people would like him or not. And then when they were under the impression there was one situation that came up where I told my dad this guy didn't like him. And we were at the hospital. Uh-huh. And it was another doctor. And come to find out, the guy ended up being a bad guy and didn't like him at all. And he was doing some things he shouldn't have done,
right,
in that hospital situation. But I don't know why the like part came along. I guess it was the easiest thing to see. I guess that's what you think about. Do people like me? Do they not like me? Do they like that person? Not like that? Because I didn't think anybody was going to harm anybody or do anything violent or anything. I wasn't exposed to that yet. It was just liking someone or not. So maybe that's just the basic, very bottom line, I think, of profiling and observing behavior.
How'd your dad get into medicine? What was his spark for that, do you think?
When he was little, he broke his ankle. And there was a doctor that he went and saw, and the guy said, well, don't you worry, we're going to fix this. And he fixed it. And he was just fascinated with how, like I was with body language, he was with medicine.
Yeah.
And he fixed his ankle and, you know, healed up. And he was like, I'm going to be a doctor. And like, sure you are. But he became a general practitioner, a surgeon, a radiologist, and was the head of the chief of staff at the Oak Ridge, Tennessee. It's where they developed most of the nuclear weapons of America. I know you probably know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've talked about some people that we may be familiar with in the same groups over there for whatever reasons. So he became the chief of staff at the Oak Ridge Hospital. And then he opened up the Oak Ridge Breast Center, which was the place that everyone came for their breast exams. It became like the number one in the nation for breast exams. And the things going along with that. So he found that niche and went in there. He was a card carrying genius. He's one of those guys.
Card carrying genius. What a great statement.
He wasn't a know-it-all, but you could talk to him about anything, literally anything. And I could talk to him about what we're talking about. And if he didn't have it, he's read all Joe Navarro's books. He's read all the Ekman books. Because once I started, when I was younger, getting into this, he was like, well, let's find out about that. We'd find out about hostage negotiation. I'll say, well, here's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to be training this. He goes, well, you know, so he found out all about that. And I could talk to him in depth about this stuff. He just kept everything he read.
Was your fascination with understanding and reading nonverbals what inspired him to get into it as well? Because he was kind of doing this naturally, it sounds like. But with your fascination of it, it sounds like, did he validate that by encouraging you to do more with it and helping you?
Oh, yeah, because he was doing it as a doctor.
Yeah.
He would tell me how they could tell when someone came in and they would say they had a kidney stone, but they were really wanting drugs. And so early on, he told me about those. And when he would go into prisons and he could tell who was really sick and who was faking it to just get a doctor in there to have, you know, get time out and talk to somebody and be hanging around. So, Yeah, I think that him getting in depth with it, going, geez, there's a whole lot here. Even though he'd read me all those things when I was a kid, when the details of human behavior started becoming, you know, you get past the very beginning stages of everything, and then you start getting into the details of micro expressions and someone, when you think, what's happening? Why do I keep, like for me, why do I keep doing this? Because I'm thinking, you know, what do people do when they're thinking, those types of things. So I think as he got further into that, he wanted to know what clinically those things meant. You know, from an analytical standpoint.
What a great father-son partnership you forged early on with him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, great guy. Greatest guy in the world.
I'm so sorry you lost him so recently as well.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
Yeah. So back then, we're inspired by the great validation our father's given us for pursuing our passion that you created for observing others and nonverbal behavior. What did you want to do back then? Do you have any idea how you want to provide for yourself when you're that young, maybe?
Yeah, because I wanted to be a studio musician when I was a little kid.
Where did that come from? That seems incongruent.
my dad was at Vanderbilt going to medical school. He was in Nashville and he was a guitar player. And he's always been a musician, piano player, and but really good at it. You know?
He was a Renaissance man.
Yeah, he really was. He really was. And so He hung out with the old school of country music, Patsy Cline. He ran in that group of people and go to the studio, and he would do sessions for all kinds of people. And when he would tell me about those, I was fascinated with it. This is still when we lived in Louisa, Kentucky.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, wow, that's great. I want to check that out. So I started playing. My brother started playing guitar and I started playing drums as a little, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years old.
I'm so sorry. 1 second, Scott. What's the birth order? Who's older and younger?
My oldest sister is the oldest one's my sister, Ellen. Uh-huh. And then there's me. And then there's my brother, Mitch. He's a year and a half younger. And my sister's 2 years older.
Okay, great. So all pretty close in age then. Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. And so since he was into music, I grew up playing guitar. And I played guitar. And that was my thing. I played guitar all the time. Didn't tell anybody. Didn't say much about it because I was under the impression everybody did. I really did. I thought everybody was. Even my friends. And I thought, well, they're not saying anything about it either. I was never a performer. I was never into going out and want to be famous guitar player. None of that. I always wanted to do the analytical side of it, you know, the studio part of it. So I just thought it was cool because with guitar, it's one thing if you play guitar and you know a bunch of songs and you can learn songs and all that, that's great. But when you start getting down into the music part of it, the arrangement of songs, which is fascinating as well, how music is arranged. And how just the way books are arranged, you have a setup for books and you have a setup for songs and all the different types of arrangements you have for songs. You have a pop song arrangement. There are only about 12 of them, really, you know, different arrangements you can do, you know, intro, verse, chorus, pre-chorus, chorus, then back. And then you switch around, you do it again. There are just a few of them, but the things you put in there to make sounds and noises and little hooks for people to like. That's what got me. I was like, that's a little sound people like that.
What age were you that you started seeing there's this undercurrent behind the music that creates the music?
Well, there's a guy named Doc Watson, and he was a famous guitar player. He was blind. And in bluegrass, he was like the most famous bluegrass guitar player of all time. Still, anybody in bluegrass knows who he is and thinks he's the greatest. And he was my dad's best friend. So they would always hang out and play songs and sing these old songs, like traditional American music, those things. And I noticed, I was like, they have the chorus, you know, the little hook in them. So when I started seeing that, my dad said, well, here's the way that works. You know, it's a hook and you do this. I was like, oh. So I started learning about that and looking at the chord progressions. Paul Simon's chord progressions are different from Eddie Van Halen's. Although they both did very well. One's more of a pop thing and one's more of a pop rock thing.
Right.
So seeing what those differences were then you have things like the Beach Boys. Then you have a pop acts like Christina Aguilera and Britney Spears and whoever kids are listening to today, all those things and New Kids on the Block and all those things, they all have specific song form to them.
And how old were you when your dad's explaining this to you?
Probably 12, 13 in junior high, I think.
Christmas. Okay, keep going. Yeah. Sorry, that's incredible.
So I got really good at spotting that and saying, oh, this is this form, and putting those together. So I was good at arranging songs as a child, you know, not a child. I guess you are a child at that age. So I got really good at that and played guitar all the time and drums all the time. And then ended up going to Berklee College of Music. I went to Lexington. I went to Transylvania University for a year and just, you know, studied music and literature. And I just, it wasn't me.
What did you want to do with it?
I just knew I was supposed to go to, you have to go to college. You know, that was the thing. You have to go to college. And then, you know, everybody thought that back then. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to go to college, but I wanted to learn, I love to read. So I wanted to learn about literature and I wanted to learn about music. So I really, it was really great on one hand, because I learned a lot about, not just, you don't just read a lot in literature. You read about the symbolism, the things, where things came from and specific writers and that kind of thing.
What got you into that?
I just read a lot when I was, I learned to read early and just really liked, I have dyslexia. So once I could get past, I'd have to focus on all the words.
Another guest with dyslexia. It's crazy.
Oh, Mark.
Yeah, Mark.
Yeah,
and
Mark Bones.
A few others on recently too. Yeah, incredible.
Yeah, so
How did you? When did you discover you had dyslexia?
Well, they didn't know what it was for a long time. I was already through, probably through high school when they started, those studies on that started coming out, because my brother has it worse than I do. Oh, and wow. He writes TV shows and movies. So it's like his thing was worse. He could hardly read, you know, but so he'd have to remember all these things. And I could hardly read as well. And so when it came to music, going back to that, when I go to my guitar lessons, because I took guitar lessons growing up all the time, I couldn't read the music, so I'd have to memorize what the teacher was doing, then come back and pretend I was reading it. Oh, until one day, this guy named Jim Whaley, who was one of my guitar teachers, he figured it out, because he played something and he made a mistake, and he kept making the mistake, and I kept pretending like I was reading that along with him. So when I'd go home to practice, I would just practice what I'd seen him do, and I kept making the mistake. And he was like, and he finally figured it out. He said, so he came in one day, he put a completely different song up, but he had it labeled as the song I was supposed to learn. Right. And it was the one he played. And so he said, it's okay. Well, there you go. Play that. And I did. And he said, play it one more time. And he goes, I don't know what you're doing here, but that's not what that is. That's not this. And it's kind of an emotional thing, because I had to be honest about it. I said, I'm just copying what you do. I was too embarrassed to tell him that I couldn't read it. And he was like, well, that's totally cool. That's fine. We don't need this anyway. We'll go ahead and do this. You know, which went to help me at Berkeley, because my ear was doing, my listening ear for things was really spot on when I got to Berkeley. So going through ear training and all those things, I just knocked that out quick and jumped. Wow. Way ahead. It was no, you know, those kind of things were no problem. I just feel like I'm bragging and stuff over here. This is an odd feeling. It's really weird. I'm so smug musically, you know. Jeez.
No, it's all my fault. I'm asking all these questions to try to understand all the intersections of your life. You have been validated and encouraged in anything you've touched, it sounded like, when you were younger. And as you're exposed to different things, people are like, yeah, that's really good. Do more of that. And
that was my parents. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Totally my parents.
And what a way to allow you to kind of flourish and maneuver in any direction. So we go to Berkeley for music.
Mm-hmm.
What's next?
Well, at Berkeley, you have a guidance counselor there, you know? And so what was happening was I was going out and doing sessions on records, you know, as I went to school.
Doing sessions on records. Talk about that. What's that? And how'd you get into that? And how'd you get chosen for that? That's crazy.
Well, usually you have to be able to read really well. But in these situations, this was Boston, you know? So there were studios there. And we had, and my friends and I put together some studios as well. And since I'd been playing since I was a kid, I could knock out any kind of style, not just play it, but I played fairly well. You know, on guitar, I could play any style fairly well. So if you needed a classical guitar for something, I could get that gig. If you needed it, especially back in the 80s, there were a lot of these rap songs, rap and dance things. There's big guitars on them. I did like 80% of those things. I was the call guy for those, for all those dance remixes, which is where I learned how to do remixes.
How did you get those? Yeah. Okay. So you have mad skills because you have reps, you know, from a really young age as a musician, but there's always more to it in any business. You know, it comes down to relationships and who you know. So who do you know and what kind of relationship got you those jobs, you think?
Well, at that point when you're in school and everybody's trying to be I was a gunslinger, because you know you had Eddie Van Halen, it was out, Randy Rhoads, his famous guitar player, was out, and this is before Steve Vai hit really big. Let me tell you a quick story.
Yeah.
So and my ego really got out of hand, man. I mean, at Berkeley, I just thought, you know, you have these people from all over the world going to Berkeley, and it was a big deal, you know. Jaco Pastorius, I don't know if you're familiar with him, he was a bass player, and he ended up living at my place for 2 weeks. I met him at Berkeley, and he didn't have, while he was there, he didn't have a place. So he stayed with us for like 2 weeks. And I got the biggest head. I mean, I thought, and I was a good guitar player, but I wasn't as good as I thought I was, you know, those kind of people. Because anybody that came in, whatever they did, I could just do it faster and remember it quicker and do all that, right? So I thought, you know, and this is where I peaked. And there was an afternoon where, as a guitar player, I completely peaked. And this is the best I ever was at this one time. Okay, and here's what happened. So they had these little rehearsal rooms at Berkeley, and you'd sit in there and practice. You know, because you and we had an apartment, but some people are in the dorms, and you didn't want to go, you know, that'd drive you nuts if you hear somebody playing guitar all the time, that, or whatever your instrument was. So they had these rehearsal rooms, just big rows of them, you know. And up to this point, I was the big gun. I was the hot guitar player at Berkeley. I was the guy. And the
you say Berkeley, but I think I got the wrong one, because you said Berkeley and you said Boston. So Berkeley.
Oh, Berkeley College of Music.
Okay. Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. Not Berkeley. Berkeley, California. This is Berkeley. Yeah. Right, after good. Lee Burke. He's the guy that founded that. Okay, and a lot of people have gone there. Some of the most famous musicians in the world have gone there. And it's really, if you get in, man, it's real. One of Mark's kids is going to go.
Oh, really?
So yeah. He's a drummer. So he's going to go there. He's going to love it.
Not surprised.
And so I thought I was just the best. And so I had my amp in my room, and I had this like a Randy Rhodes looking guitar. You know, I got whatever the Randy Rhodes guitar was, I got that one. And I was playing a little too loud, but people would stand outside and go, and I was just like, yeah, you know, you're like, cool, man, I'm bad. And because I knew they were standing out there trying to learn how to do these things I was already doing, which I was just ripping off from Eddie Van Halen and Randy Rhodes and whoever else, you know, because it's already been done. You're just copying it and adding to it, right?
Right.
So, and every now and then somebody knock on the door and come in, well, can you show me so-and-so? Yeah, sit down, I'll show you him. So one time I was doing, and this is what I was thinking just before, I thought, man, I really got this together, you know, this is going to be great. And as I peeked, there's a knock on the door, right? And everybody has this little thing, the guitar players, and everybody that's a guitar player might be listening now. You have your own little piece that you play to impress the girls or whoever, you know, my friends will come over, and you have this one piece that lasts a little, maybe a minute, and it's like Eruption or one of those short little pieces that you do everything in, right? And I'd been working on this for, you know, since I was in high school. I played this thing every day. I had it down, man. It was so good. It was beautiful, but it was like this rock thing, and it had all the... There's a guy named Stanley Jordan who was a different style of player, but he also played like the Eddie Van Halen thing like that, but he would play with all it. So I had some of that worked out, because I'd met with him a couple of times. He's like, here's how you do this. This is building up. Believe me, it's going to pay off. So I'm in there thinking, really cool. And there's a knock on the door, and this guy comes in. He's this tall, skinny guy with a lot of hair. And he says, hey, man. I said, I heard you playing out there. And I'm like, I had long hair and two earrings. Right. So I was like, yeah. And he goes, can you mind if I listen to me? You play it for me? And I said, yeah, sure, man. Sit down and see. And so he came in. And I've actually got the guitar sitting over here, because I took it out of the case the other day to clean it. But let me show you this guitar real quick.
Get it.
It's hilarious. It just happens to be sitting under the table there, because I was cleaning it. So this is the guitar I was using. It's a Randy Rhodes Starvel Jackson. Oh. So anyway, I played my piece there, right? And he goes, oh, that's really cool. He said, can I see your guitar? I said, yeah, man, you know, I'll just play my guitar. This guy, hand to God, this guy played what I just played, that I've been doing since I was in high school. He saw it one time and played it back to me better than I ever had, and had all this really cool stuff to it. And you see people when they see something blow up in their mouth or something, like, what the, you know, and I had this look, I'm sure a look of horror on my face. And he flipped the guitar back here. I said, yeah, that's a nice guitar. And I was like, oh God. And I said, of course, who are you? He said, my name's Steve. I'm Steve Vai. And if you don't know who Steve Vai is, he's like one of the top guitar players in the whole world. Right. And the guy came in and just shamed me in front of me. Nobody watching, just me and him, and just stuck it up. And from that day on, I was like, oh, I said, I'm doing this wrong. And he goes, yeah, you're doing it wrong. I said, okay, how do you do it? He goes, just be yourself. Just be cool, man. You know, you can play, just go do that. And I was like, okay. So from then on, that changed everything. That's when I started getting more studio gigs, because I wasn't an ex anymore. Right. I wasn't so big head. I was like, because he completely shamed me in front of me, you know, without embarrassing me in front of anybody. He embarrassed me in front of me because I guess he's seen that before. And that's all he had to do.
What made him want to come in and do that?
Because I'm sure people are saying, there's that guy I've been telling you about that who does, you know, who thinks he's the coolest guy in the world. Because I did too. I thought I was so cool, man. Because I could do it all.
Do you think he did it out of wanting to shame you or wanting to teach you?
No. No, he wanted to teach me. He's a teacher.
Great guy.
So, I mean, he teaches people, but he didn't want to shame me, you know, in front of me. He would have said, he would have left the door open and said, and brought somebody with him as a witness. You know what I mean? And I'm sure he never thought I would go out and tell this story. You know, he may not even remember it.
Yeah.
I've seen him a couple of times since then, and he gives me that thing that he was like, he remembers it, but you know, I don't know if he does.
And how old were you when this happened?
In my early 20s, I was probably 19 or 20. That's when that incredible. Happened.
Yeah. And so did you recognize it at the moment that, wow, I now have humility?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Because from that day forward, I was bummed out for like 3 days. I was like, I got to redo this whole thing. And every part of my life where I thought I was so cool, because everything was related to that. I got a haircut. I got rid of the earrings. You know, I quit trying to be the cool gal. I really did. I was like, I can't do this. Is not working. This is not cool. You know?
What wasn't cool about it? So that's interesting take you had on yourself, because you had mad skills, but for some reason you decided you were no longer it.
Okay, let's pretend. Let's take, we both know Joe Navarro. Let's say we're talking about Joe Navarro. What if Joe came in and was like, I'll tell you what that guy's going to do next, or this guy is guilty, because what if he had this really shit attitude, you know, just like he's the coolest guy in the world, since he's the dang, you know, the King Kong of behavior and body language.
Right.
What if he was like that? What if he was acting like, that's what it would be. I'm not saying I was that, but I'm saying I thought I was the King Kong of that. And I really wasn't. I was just a little, dumb little monkey that King Kong came in and went, sit down, stupid. Let me show you what you're doing wrong.
Sit down, stupid. Let me show you. That's what I'm like with when I watch the four of you do your analysis of anyone and anything, because you guys have such mad skills and reps.
all of our stuff is different. Everybody comes from a different angle.
Yep.
That's it. That's the only difference in it. Yeah, we all love these, you know, like these same books. We all have all, you know, these.
Yep, some of them. I recognize all of them.
Yeah, yeah. And the one that has the most, it's like my fourth copy of this. And as stupid as that sounds, because it's one book and you read it and you got it. Man, this book, he's written other stuff, tons of other stuff. It's great. Yep. Man, this is my favorite one. This is where everything is for me. That's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. And Eggman stuff's all good. You know, unmasking. That's a good one. Telling Lies. That's a good one. All this. And I just found this the other day on eBay. It's Effective Neuroscience.
Ooh.
I don't know if you've seen that before. Oh man. No. And it's hard to find in a, if you get the hardbacks, like $1,000, but I got this for like $70.
Wow.
But I think it's on Amazon too.
Yeah. You know?
But it's in such great shape. So I've been going back through that again. I haven't seen that in years. But man, it's a good one.
You know? It is.
But so back to my point, if Joe would come in, if you met him and he was being all snotty and like, I'm the coolest guy in the world, that's what it'd be like. It would totally bum you out. That's what it would be like, because that's what I was doing. I was like, yeah, I got to figure it out. You know, I thought I did.
Right. All right. So we have this humbling moment. What did you decide to do next?
Well, then after I got my hair cut and got rid of the earrings and started, you know, doing sessions the way you're supposed to, instead of going with an attitude, things really started happening, you know, ended up becoming a record producer, learned how to do remixes. Did a lot of dance crap. I'd done so much pop schlock music. I won't go in depth of while it was, but man, it was so bad. But I hear it now. I'm like, oh my God, if that ever gets out. But it was really, some of it was really schlocky. And so from there, once I got all that happening, I saw the music trend. And at the same time, keep in mind, I'm still way into body language. I'm still learning every day, everything I can do. It was
And why
guitars.
Was that? I mean, were they congruent at all in skills and techniques and observation? Or were they completely bifurcated and separate?
I'd just grown up doing both. So I'm just doing what I'd always been doing. You know, and so with body language, if you understand that, you can work in any place. I've focused on healthcare a lot. So because I understand that world and I understand doctors, how to talk to them.
Yeah.
But if you're in the studio, you can you can see someone who really wants to do something that you're not asking them to do yet. And if you need to get something out of somebody, as corny as that sounds, a guitar player or a singer or whatever, you have to be able to talk to them and show them things that can, and see when they think they've got something or they're thinking about something else. without going, I can see you're thinking about something else. Why don't you tell me, you know, you don't do that. You say, hey man, what are you, you think of anything else? What do you, you know, what do you got? So then they'll be able to let that go. And it worked out really well for me being able to do that. I mean, the body language part coming over and mixing with the music part worked so well because I could communicate and see what musicians, a lot of times they don't communicate well because they hang out with other musicians and all they do is smoke cigarettes and drink coffee and practice.
Right.
So they don't get a lot of, and the only time they, you know, some people you see them, all they want to do is go out and drink and do all that stuff. But there's really no time for that if you're going to be really good at it.
Right.
So you have to be able to communicate with them and see what they might be thinking or want to do next. Because you can have a drummer who's an awesome drummer and they're just playing the little part you want to play and that's what you want. But there's sometimes you'll see it and go, dude, you know, what do you think about that? I don't really like this one section. Do you think you could think of anything without saying, I can tell you're thinking of another section to play, part for this section. And get them to do that. Get them to go ahead and go a little extra, go a little further each time, you know, without hurting their feelings or making them mad. Or if you are going too far, you can tell if somebody's getting mad or not.
So it wasn't just your ability to observe and understand body language as well as the music world. You're also having a great ability to communicate and inspire people to listen rather than trying to convince them to listen to your ideas. Where did your ability to really communicate come from? Were you inspired people to listen?
I don't know. I think it came from showing off as a kid, you know, trying to be funny when I was a little kid. Uh-huh. As my brother and I always had contests, who was the funniest, who could make the most people laugh or make somebody laugh first. So I think being able to communicate something to them quickly to make them laugh before he did, that was probably my
amazing competition.
yeah. So, and he's much funnier than I am. I mean, he's like professional funny. I mean, he's, you know, he's a funny guy.
He I love that funny. Professional funny.
Yeah, no, he really is. You know, that's what he does. He writes that for a living. You know,
that's crazy. So,
yeah.
Did you have any humbling moments where you learned what you weren't doing well in that area of communication, or you just had it from such a young age that it was just part of who you were?
I was really lucky when I was in Boston as well, because there was a guy named Michael Johnson, who was a record producer, and his brother, Maurice Starr. And they took a liking to me and hired me as a guitar player for their studio. And it was called Mission Control. And they would tell me, they explained a lot of things to me. I really got lucky from hanging out with them because they're African American and I was a white dude. You know, I was the guitar player. And they really sort of took me under their wing and said, here's how you do this. Here's how you talk to people doing this. And I would get to go in and just sit and watch sessions when I first started, because I would just show up as a guitar player and doing that's great. I thought I had figured out. But being able to watch not just a song, but an album being done by sitting in the corner and watching how they dealt with people and being creative as well, then that made all the difference in the world. Being able to watch them do that and not look at me like I'm, you know, like I'm an idiot or do you get it? They were like, that's how you do it. It wasn't like, see, it works like this. They were like, watch this. More of that type of thing than here's how it works. They were just like, watch this. So I can put it together myself. So I got really lucky there.
Great, great healthy mentors along the way, no doubt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It sounds like you had, like we said, a lot of great healthy mentors. It doesn't sound like anyone ever shut you down in anything you wanted to do. Was there anyone or anything that you got shut out of?
I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't think so. I really didn't remember what we've talked about all the three of the things I've ever wanted to do.
I know. So I was curious. I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. So that was it. It's the only three. I'm sure if I had another one, probably.
All right. So cool. So what's next?
I'm really into this as healthcare has changed.
Yeah.
You know, from it's in the squatter right now. And doctors and healthcare people are having problems communicating with the patients and the people surrounding that. I'm trying to fix that. As corny as that sounds. That's my deep dive. I want to try to get in there and see if I can fix that, teaching them how to deal with people. You know, I feel people say, I can go anywhere and talk to anybody. But if you give me 5 minutes or 10 minutes in a room with anybody, I can get them to talk to me. Whether they like me for real or not, I have no earthly idea. But you know how it is in interrogation. I can get pretty much anybody to like me for that first, you know, 4 to 7 minutes in there. Then after that, you have to keep feeding it. So it'll, depending on what the situation is or what you need for them. And I do that in the interrogation thing because I have to do it. I can get anybody to love me and think that we're a kindred spirit for 4 to 7 hours. That's about how long it takes me to get somebody to tell me what they've done, right, or tell me where the money is or how they took it. So after that, you know, I don't know. But That's one thing. I feel like I can make bus drivers. I can make cops. I can make anybody like me for that first 4 to 7 hours to get that done. After that, I don't know. I don't remember what my point was there, what your question was, but I remember I say that all the time about that.
Yeah. You start off with healthcare and how that became your passion.
Oh, yeah.
For doctors communicating. What was the spark that said, we got a problem here that you discovered and you're going to have a solution for it?
When I went to my doctor, one of my doctors, I ended up having cancer. So I went and saw a lot of doctors and everything's fine. It was the kind you want. It was thyroid cancer, took my thyroid out and everything's cool. But during that process, I saw this thing is in a wreck. The healthcare system is a wreck, communicating with your doctors and healthcare people, getting things done. Because when you walk in, that was when they first say, go over there and sign at the kiosk. And I was like, do what? And just somebody just went, they looked up like this, went, yeah, go sign at the kiosk. And I was like, what the hell? What are you talking about? You know, my regular doctor, I got to do this. And go, what? You know, so I was like, oh man, this isn't good. This is real bad. And I saw it just get worse.
They weren't your dad.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So they weren't my dad. And my dad, and I said, you know, this thing's broken, right? He goes, oh yeah. So he told me all the things. I said, yeah, it's exactly what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
So I talked to him about how to fix it, how you go about it, what needs to be fixed and all that. And he knew all that as well.
Yeah.
So my whole healthcare thing is based on that. I do a lot of talks on that, a lot of trainings on that as well.
What a great legacy. What a great legacy he gave you to carry on for him.
Yeah. Yeah. Got real lucky.
Yeah. It's powerful. Now, as folks know, I'm not a luck guy. I believe that the relationships we forge in life give us the path to walk. And that's what you have. You forge great relationships. You bring everything you have to the fight and you're walking the path.
Oh, well, thank you. That makes me sound so much cooler than I am.
Yeah, I know. You keep saying you're very boring. How could this is not a boring life by any stretch of the imagination? Ugh, no, all right. So, Scott, we got into body language for healthcare professionals. What's next? Or I should say, what else? Because I know you're still doing that, right?
Well, I think I'm hoping the training that Greg and I are putting together, like we have this body language tactics and the True Crime Workshop, and we have other things sitting in the wings that we're getting ready to bring out soon. I like training people. I like teaching people the stuff that I know, you know, all that, because everybody, like I was saying on behavior panel, we all come from different areas. Everybody comes from a different place and they're explaining stuff and training stuff. So in my stuff, I want to tell people how you get along with other people, not to be that person who thinks you're the coolest guy in the world or whatever.
How not to be the guy you were when you're 23 years old.
That was bad. It was so bad, but how to get past that.
Right.
And so I really want to do something, as corny as it sounds, with healthcare. I like training cops. I like training military. I love that because I hope I'm doing something. I think I am. It keeps somebody from getting killed.
Yeah.
You know, and all that. So they'll be more aware of what's going on around them. But I really think I'll be able to help in healthcare because help alleviate those the pain in the relationships of the doctor and the nurses and the receptionists in that situation. With the patients, you know, because it's horrible. It's scary, man.
What was the bridge to get into doing body language training full time from that world? I mean, how did that happen?
I've always hung out with people who were either cops or they're going to be cops. I don't know why, because I'm a puss. I couldn't do that. I couldn't go around and kick it indoors and arresting people and chase. I'm not that guy. But I always, those people fascinated because I know something's wrong with them because they go do that. You know, to have the, you know, be able to just,
I know there's something wrong with them.
Yeah. We don't know what's in there. We hear shooting. I'm going to go ahead and go in there. Come on, let's all go. I'm not that guy, man. I just couldn't do it. Like, it's why I could never be in the military, because they kicked me out for crying too much, for whining all the time. It's too hot out here. You know, that whole thing. Couldn't do that either. So I like being around them, but I didn't want to be one of them.
All right.
So the closest thing I could do was train them. And not that I thought I was cooler and could tell them, but when I started talking to these guys about well, what did you see when this happened? They would say, you sure are interested in that, you know? And I was like, yeah, I am. And so once it dawned on them that I could tell them, give them a heads up on what someone might do when they're getting ready to run. What happens before they get ready to run? You know, that quick little look and they hunch down and bolt. You know, several things leading up to that, but you can always tell, like, dude, you're right, that happened. So they thought that was fascinating. So I just talked to these guys about what's going to happen next. And I realized I was training myself to train as well. Right. And Oak Ridge, we have the, you know, as you know, we have the CIA, we have the FBI, we have Six, everybody's here. you know, right. or everybody's in Oak Ridge. So you can meet these people and talk to them. And you could go, and when I first moved to Oak Ridge, little kids, I could go watch that training because of some connections that that got made there. So right. I could go watch them, you know, and I was like, ah, I picked it up quick, you know, really quick.
Who was the first one / when was the time frame that happened? Like, who was the first person in law enforcement or any of the 3-letter agencies that looked at you and heard you saying these things and said, Scott, you really need to help us with this area?
Oh, with that came later, because when I started training, it was when I started learning it. It was a cop in our town. One of his kids said, you know, I see you like this stuff. My dad says you can come watch them train in their body language. You know, they didn't call it body language back then. It was like, right. I don't even remember. It was like behavioral something. If you want to. So they talked to my parents and said, yeah, you could go. So I got in, I think my sophomore year of high school.
Oh, so that's a fascinating link right there. So you were actually already connected to having a fascination with law enforcement and there's a thread I didn't know existed. All right, so that makes sense. Okay, good.
Yeah. So yeah, I got started early in that too. I just got started early in everything.
Yeah. Well, we're all born with a great curiosity, and yours was just never squashed. Fantastic. Yeah. You know, it's a great gift to have, and a great gift that you can pass on to others. All right, so we're now in the world of training on body language and human behavior with all these law enforcement and 3-letter agencies folks. What's that about? How's that going?
Really good, because I was talking the way they could explain. Mostly it was, if you remember, it was a lot of old people doing that, or the older guys and older women. So I was saying, here's what you do, because I was doing to them just what was done to me by Steve Vai, and going, hey man, here's how you do this. Look, and those guys in the studio, look man, here's how you do this. You do, you know, and setting everything out for them without going, you know, getting all technical. Well, this is the this and this is that. Although I do know all that stuff, who gives a hoot? It's so horrifically boring. That's why, and let's go back to Joe Navarro. He words his stuff. If you read his stuff, man, everything is worded so perfectly.
Oh yeah.
And this is before I got way into his stuff. But I knew there was a way to explain these things so everybody could easily understand it, you know, so because you could pick it up and by saying, here's what really happens, and then showing, breaking out of the, we're training because of this. And if you look up here, if we talk about this, who cares? What's going to happen next? You know, I understand the brain. I understand what's going to happen neurologically. I understand what you go through. I get it. But what's that got to do with me? If I'm going to chase somebody, someone's getting ready to shoot at me, or I pull somebody over and I walk up, what the hell's going on in there, man? That's what they want to know. You know, if there's somebody behind a door and, you know, and they're just talking to me, how do I know they're not getting ready? You can't know really, but what's letting me know that the possibility that's could be worse than what I'm thinking it's going to be, or it could than what it appears to be. All those kind of things. And there are ways to talk about those things where you can understand, anybody can understand it easily if you do it correctly. So I got kind of popular in that world for being able to do that quickly.
So you're a master of understanding and observing human behavior, but you also have this uncanny ability to kind of reverse that optic and also say, this is what people want to see and want to hear and want to feel in these situations. I know it comes from your musical background and understanding how stories are told and how songwriting is constructed. Mm-hmm. How does that look? I mean, how do you do that?
Well, here's how the behavior panel goes back to my music days. Okay. Right. And I've never told this. And first person I told this to, I think, was Greg. And then I told Chase and then Mark. And I think I might've told them all at one time, but I'll tell you what I did. I treated the behavior panel like it was a band.
Right.
And when you have, like when New Kids on the Block was put together, New Edition was put together, if each person there has a personality. So every person in those four people have to have a personality. Somebody's people can connect to. So you got to have somebody who's like the bass player, who's like, which would be Mark, you know, or Greg, because, you know, he's more of an aggressive type, but you don't know it until you start messing with him. Then do what you don't want to do. That's when he gets aggressive with you, because this is like some dude over there playing the bass, right? And then you have like the drummer, you know, which would be Mark, because Mark's doing all kinds of stuff. It's more like a rock band that's just learning.
Right.
But, you know, you have Mark that does his stuff, you know, so it's like... Yeah, in real life, everybody thinks it's the drums and the bass follows the drums, but the drums follow the bass. So you've got Greg being the bass player. And so we all kind of, that vibe is what we're trying to get, but he's the only one that's got that vibe on him, you know, that, oh, we're cool guys. So then Mark is more the drummer. And then I'd be more the guitar player because that's my world. And you have to go out and say, in my case, it's bringing personality to what we're doing, pointing out what people do and all that. And then we have to have a lead singer, a good looking lead singer. So that's what Chase is. So he's our singer. So that's why I push him out there all the time, or we push him out there all the time.
Right.
So, because, you know, he's the singer and the chicks dig him, you know, in old terms. So that's the way I see it. And so after our first show, I was like, this looks like I could do this. And so and without telling him, I would say, well, Mark, you always do this or that, you know, what about, and he'd go into his stuff and Greg is saying, yeah, you're saying that. What about this? And, or, you know, or when I would talk to him. And same thing with Chase. And I always make fun of Chase and tell, you know, make fun of him being good looking. So I always tell him how I'm better looking than he is. And like, there's this thing on it. So that's the bottom line for that. I mean, it's all, I treat it like a band, you know? So there's nobody really in charge, but all of us are in charge. All of us are driving.
Right.
You know? So but that's the approach. That's the approach. That's how it connects to
all it took was an entire lifetime of reps in all these different areas to be able to put that together.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen by mistake. It doesn't happen by luck. It happens by focus. It happens by passion. It happens by mad skills. It happens with great mentors, teachers, and guides in our lives. Yeah. Humility. I mean, all these things coming together for a perfect formula of putting it together to give people skills, tools, and things in their lives that'll make them richer and happier every day. So what's it like being on Dr. Phil and going on again?
It's great. He's such a good guy. It's one of those things where everyone else goes, what's Dr. Phil like? And you think it's this guy you're seeing on TV. It's a lot of that. But 15 minutes in hanging around with him, he's just like some dude. You know, he's like some guy you'd want to hang out with. He really is a good guy. He's a cool guy. I'm not just saying that, but he really is. Once you hang out with him, you go, oh, I get it. I get it. That's why those people, and the cat knows everybody, man. This guy knows everybody. Yeah. I mean, I've done, I don't know how many shows with him, quite a few of them. And every time I go on there, he goes, here's my friend so-and-so. They're not just, he's known these people. Nikki Sixx from Motley Crue. He's known him for a lot. They're like tight, man. You know, you think, oh yeah, he knows him. But when you see him talking and goofing around, it's like, holy smokes, they are friends. You know, and he never sticks it in your face. Or I don't know, you gotta meet him. You'd love him. He'd love you. Yeah, he would. He'd absolutely love you. But he's a good guy. I really like that guy a lot. I really do. We all do. All four of us do. Because he can relate to everybody. He's one of those guys. Yeah, he's got that figured out.
Great mad skills. It's why great communicators are the ones that are forging the way forward for all of us in the world and being able to pass that along to others and demonstrate those skills through their behavior. Scott, what are the things that I not cover that you want to make sure you share with everyone before we start closing it out a little bit?
My MMA skills.
Go.
I got nothing, man. I think we're good to go.
And out of all these things too, you've done a lot of pretty incredible things and still are every day. What's been the most fun? What have you enjoyed the most?
Oh, Lord. I don't know. I don't have any hobbies or anything. So it's everything I do is reading. My hobby, sort of.
Reading is your hobby.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess so. That would be it. But I don't know. It's all the music business was great, man. That was fun. I retired in 2011, so I'm out of that. But I really like doing what I'm doing now. I really do. It's because you get to meet people who've done things they shouldn't have done. So you see a part of humanity nobody gets to see, rarely, you know how it is. There's a group that gets to see that, but everybody else doesn't get to see it. So you feel like you're on the inside. But that's I tell you what I like the most. It's like getting somebody to tell me what they did and didn't want to tell anybody about it. That's the buzz I get when they finally tell me what's happening. When they finally, you know, without nailing it, without going, oh, you said it, because you know that never happens. When I finally get it out of them, that's the buzz I get. I really like that a lot. I mean, that's the high I'm chasing all the time. I'm looking for those opportunities.
Yeah, and it requires
when I go into those.
It requires a very deep connection with someone to be able to do that. And I think that's what that high comes from. It's like, wow, I connected with this human being at such a deep level. They're willing to share anything with me.
Yeah, yeah, that's the thing. You got to make them think you're kindred spirits, man. That's the key.
And it's got to be real. It's got to be congruent. There is no doubt.
Yeah.
Scott, where can people go to find out more about you and all the great things that you have to offer and bring you into their lives?
Bodylanguagetactics.com. Everything's pretty much there.
It'll be in the show notes. So, I've been there. I love it. You and Greg are doing amazing things with that skill set and sharing it with others. And for for everyone listening, for me, thank you from the bottom of my heart of being who you are and bring great value to our lives. Tremendous having you on. Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks for having me. I really do appreciate it. I had a blast talking about me.
No better topic in the world. All right, Scott, we'll see you soon.
Okay, thanks, man.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Forged by Trust. Remember, if you want to forge trust, it's not how you make people feel about you that matters. It's how you make them feel about themselves. If you're interested in more information about how I can help you forge your own trust-building communication and interpersonal strategies for yourself or your organization, please visit me on my website at www.peopleformula.com. I'm looking forward to sharing my next Forged by Trust with you next week when we chat with Denise Logan and what's next.